Good morning. Good morning. Wow. I did not expect, as you saw in my email that I sent out to those who would register before Sunday, I sent out my introductory email. I didn't expect that we'd have as many as we do for a February series. I'm glad that I have other people sharing the beautiful sunshine that we're enjoying today. The rule in Toronto is that if it's warm, it's cloudy. If it's cold, then it's sunny. So I'll take the cold and the sun. I'm good with that. But thank you very much for participating in the series. I want to thank Beth Emmett for hosting, and Betty for volunteering to take care of all of the registration and payment beforehand. Betty's a volunteer, so it'd be nice. Even if you're not a volunteer, you know. Be nice, but if anybody needs to settle up after class, I'll stick around for a little bit for that as well. Please do make sure that I have your name. I see some people here who I know I don't have them registered yet, and I need to have that in order to be able to add you to the email list. So if you didn't register in advance and you didn't speak to Betty, please make sure that you speak to me and that I have your email address for the email list. Those who haven't been here before, I usually send out a follow-up email after the class, summarizing a little bit what we talked about, addressing questions that came up that were not addressed during class, as well as giving a link to the audio recording, and that you'll get every week. So please make sure that you sign up in order to get those emails. And last introductory note, actually, next to last introductory note, is that this is a four-part series. God willing, in March, we'll have another series as a pre-Pesach series, a pre-Passover series. So stay tuned for more information about that, dates, and so on. Yes, that series, God willing, will be, we haven't said everything yet, but I think a series will be with Rabbi Sammy Bergman, my new Sagan. Some of you heard him yesterday at Adaf Israel. He's a lot of fun, and he also stopped in during the previous series that we did in the fall. But again, details still forthcoming. The last introductory note is I wanted to dedicate the learning this morning for two people who are ill. One is Pesach David, son of Adel, and the other is Aaron, son of Sarah. So I gave you, those who have seen recent classes where I've gone on to like three or four pages. So this is a refresher. This is going back to the way I like to do source sheets, which is fitting everything on one page. But I gave you on the sheet a piece from a very interesting speech called To Better Serve and Protect, Preserving Peace and Protecting Human Rights Through Lessons Learned from the Holocaust. It was given, as you see on the sheet, by Charles H. Ramsey, who's the chief of police in Washington, D.C., the Metropolitan Police Department there. And it was given at the opening night program for Holocaust Education Week in Toronto in 2004. So some of you may have been there at the time, but it's been 16 years, so I think a refresher is probably in order. Sorry, I'm going to try to work with the room size. It's always a reminder. I have to adjust based on the room, and I know this room is, you can get lost in the size of the space. So I'm going to be a little bit louder. Apologies to those who are listening on the recording. But Chief of Police Ramsey talked about, among other things, his tour of the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., when he took the position as Chief of Police, and the impact it had on him, such that he made that part of the training of new police officers. They have to go to the Holocaust Museum. And he actually has this nice piece in his speech where he talks about the difference between that and sensitivity training. He says that's not about sensitivity training. It's about basic police work. Take a look at source number one. And I gave you the link there. Obviously, people aren't going to want to retype that whole link, but I sent this out in advance to those who had registered by Sunday. I'm going to send it out again with the follow-up email from today's class. So if you're on the email list, you will get this, and then you can just click on the link instead of having to retype all of that. He says, I left that first visit to the museum haunted by the photographs and the other images and information that I had been exposed to. I also left with a vague sense that inside that museum there were lessons, vitally important lessons for myself and really for every police officer. I didn't have a clear idea of what those lessons were, but I knew that they were there somewhere. So a few days later, I decided to go back and tour the museum again, on my own this time. And I lingered for several hours trying to take it all in again and sort things through. It was during that second visit to the museum that I realized what had haunted me so much during my first trip. It was the fact that the police, local law enforcement, my chosen profession, had played such an important role in the Holocaust. I wasn't aware of that fact, and I figured that most police officers today probably weren't aware of it either. What's he talking about when he says that the that police had such a role in the Holocaust? What does he mean? The Gestapo, right? He's talking about the way that they were actually involved in rounding up Jews, in sending them off to the camps, in destroying homes, businesses, and so on, right? That's the that is what he's talking about. What's your reaction when you hear the these remarks, when you see what he's saying here?
Well, if you know anything about the Holocaust, it doesn't surprise you. Mm. If you don't, then it may surprise you. And also, local police officials also were very implicit.
Right. Right. So if you're familiar with what Diane said, if you're familiar with the Holocaust, this isn't surprising. This is what we know about. If you're not familiar, it comes as a shock. And there was someone else who was going to say something here. I didn't see. Elaine? Yeah.
We like to think of police as the people who protect us,
mm-hmm.
and provide safety for the population. And here they're completely the opposite.
Right. What Elaine said is that we think of police, or we hope that we learn to think of police as a resource, as protection, as something friendly. The truth of the matter is that Jews are not the only ones in this boat. There are many groups, particularly ethnic minorities, who say that while they're supposed to be able to think of the police as protectors, in practice they fear the police. Obviously, Black Lives Matter is one group that has taken a strong stand regarding police and saying that they view them as antagonistic. And this is nothing that I'm saying is an endorsement of a particular point of view. I'm stating a reality. This is the position that they take. And I think it's true that public perception is that police can and do fall into the trap of either themselves becoming abusive or being used toward that end, particularly if you have a despot, if you have some kind of a tyrant in control who's going to use the police as an arm of the government that wishes to wield them in that way. At the same time, don't kid yourself, you can't have society without police. There's just no way to do it, right? There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot which says that you should pray for the government. If not for fear of the government, each person would swallow up the next. You need somebody there who's going to enforce the law. And for other reasons that we're going to discuss, we're also going to see that the Torah mandates the existence of a police force. So where we're going to have to address, and this is what I hope to deal with in our series, is this basic tension. On the one hand, saying it's dangerous to have people who are put in a position of power and whose job is to enforce the law, and who could, they have the means, use that in a way that is harmful to those who don't have power. And on the other hand, you need them, and they can be not just benign, but they can be the most helpful force within society. They can be an aid to those who are vulnerable. They can be a protector to those who have been victims. And they often are. So, how do you balance that? And how do you come up with a code of ethics that helps in order to make sure that police can do what they need to do, that those who go into police work are empowered to do what they came there to do while avoiding the risks that come with it. Stephen.
So perception plays a large role. I spent the evening with my good Chinese friends the other day, and he flipped me around on the position of what's happened in Hong Kong. It's not what, unless you really look into it and you understand it, most people, like me, have the absolute wrong perception of the police role.
Meaning?
Meaning the police were doing their jobs and the students were the ones who were at fault. And I would never have believed that, but he gave me a very convincing argument, not a discussion about it.
So Stephen points out that when you're dealing with these issues of police versus, it often depends, your view often depends on whom you ask, which side of this you are experiencing. And it's certainly true that media loves the underdog, and police are rarely viewed as the underdog. And so the result is that often the police are portrayed as being brutal, and that's because you're hearing it from the side of those who are not happy, those who are on the receiving end. And that's certainly true. At the same time, you have to recognize that the truth really may be that, not to be cliche, but both sides sometimes are right. It's entirely possible that police are put in an untenable position, that they may have to face a situation in which they are doing their job and protecting some, and yes, others are going to get hurt. You can't deny that that's a possibility. I heard one voice over there say, when I asked the question of how do you come up with a code of ethics, the response was, you can't.
That was me.
That was you. I was pretty sure.
It was me. You know, Jerry's a criminal lawyer, and we have cases all the time where police officers who have been doing their job for years, sometimes they see a person of color and they don't act respectfully or appropriately. And it just, how can you monitor that?
Right. So Betty's point is that realistically, and speaking as the spouse of a criminal defense lawyer, you know, she sees it. There are people who are police for many, many years, and then in a specific situation will act in a way that's inappropriate. And how can you defend against that? But I think it's really important to recognize that our goal is not, and this is true across the board when it comes to policy matters, our goal is not to be 100% successful. 100% success will be wonderful. But it's not realistic. And not only that, you heard the line, hard cases make for bad law, right? When you try to legislate based on the hardest cases, based on the most challenging ones, to say, I'm going to prevent even that, the result is that you create laws that make things worse in the other 95% of cases. That's where that goes. Because you're trying to legislate to prevent this worst case scenario that happens here, but you have to create such restrictions in order to avoid that from happening, that you will create problems in other circumstances where the flexibility is needed. So I don't think the goal is to be ironclad. I think the goal is to come up with a set of rules that will govern as great a majority of cases as you can. Yes.
Two things in Canada. One is the police issue in Caledon, which is, I don't think they acted properly. And secondly, if there's a conflict here between Jews and Arabs, or Muslims, which is the common thing, they tend to take out, the Jews are less people, so they control it better by controlling the Jewish people who may be in right, but they avoid a riot or something. So my idea of what the police are doing is they're enforcing the peace instead of the law, and I'm not sure if that's good or bad, but they seem to be in situations like, let's make sure everything is okay, rather than, if he did wrong, take him out of the group. But then the group riots. So I see that as a problem.
Right. So that's a very interesting question. The question of enforcing the peace versus enforcing the law. Right? Where, in the event that you do certain things to enforce the law, the result is going to be popular unrest. And so it's easier to just say, we're going to let certain things go, or we're going to side with this group, maybe they are the majority, maybe they are the loudest, in order to maintain an overall level of calm, even though they're in the wrong legally. So we have to get to that. We have to talk about that. It's an important question. I'm going to go a little bit further with what we have here, just because, you know, there is stuff here. But I, as I said in the introductory email that I had sent on Sunday, I do want to allow for that kind of discussion, because there's a lot that is worth discussing in that regard. Take a look at the second source, please. The second source is from later in the same speech that I quoted in number one. He says, he's talking here about the impact of Holocaust training on police officers. And he says, the Holocaust training also reminds us that local police must never become so politicized, as they were in Nazi Germany, that we exist primarily to carry out the will of political leaders, or to simply look the other way when political agendas or atrocities are carried out. Our authority as police officers come not from the politicians. Our power and authority come from the people. And above all else, our role as police officers is to protect and preserve the rights of the people. The right to assemble, the right to speak, the right to worship, the right to petition and criticize one's government, the right to be secure in our homes, our possessions, and our beliefs. Defending these rights for all people, all of the time, is what ultimately defines us as police officers. And we can never allow those principles to be undermined or eroded. It's a nice applause line. There's nothing here not to like. Yes, Brenda.
Aren't we living through this right now with the DOJ?
What do you mean?
Well, the Department of Justice is not working the way it should in the United States. We're living through that exact thing.
So you're looking at it on a government level. In other words, I agree with you that the Department of Justice is supposed to be law enforcement. I've just been thinking about it more on the street level and the police officer. You're taking it up to the government.
Yeah.
Yeah, to the government level. So
at least in Canada,
yeah,
Department of Justice has nothing to do with the police. The police are Solicitor General. That's the beauty of it, is there's two separate ministries.
So,
and in every province.
In my strong desire to avoid discussion about what's going on south of the border, the speech I did not watch last night, and so forth, I want to address the issue of it with separating it from the particular events. But yes, speaking to the main point, I think I've been thinking about it on the micro level, but it is an issue on the macro level, the politicization of what is supposed to be what Chief of Police Ramsey calls an entity meant to be serving the freedoms of and the protection of the population, not the ends of and the protection of those who are in power. So I definitely agree with that point. I think it's an interesting approach he's advocating, viewing the police as agents of the people rather than agents of the government. But does that work? Can that work? Yeah.
It depends on the government, because they want to enact the law, and the police will carry out the law, correct?
Right.
So
to restate that, the problem with it is that police really are the agents of the government. They may have a mission of protecting the population, but make no mistake, their mission comes from the government, which defines who the population is that's going to be protected. It defines what the rules are for the protection of the population. They may be there to help the citizens, but they are agents of the government, and they are meant to police the acts of citizens. I think this conflict about the mentality of police is the basis for much of the strife we've seen in recent decades. You can go back to the 60s if you want. You can go to the 80s and the riots in Los Angeles and Rodney King and all of that. And you can go up to our own time and Black Lives Matter and you know, police abuses and brutalities and it's the same story fundamentally. It's the question of, does it really matter if you say they are meant to serve the people if they are agents of government? And the question comes up not just in terms of secular ethics, but in terms of Judaism. Because the Torah also frames police as agents of government. And we'll see that very shortly. So how do you set up police to succeed and not fall into the trap of becoming abusive? So I think we should look at the job description of the police department. I think that helps to really crystallize the problem. What is the job of a police department? What are the roles that a police department plays? Before you look at number three, please. Yes, Arlene.
Before we go there, I know there's a difference because Ramsey talked about police, and the RCMP might come up police officers rather than police officers. So there's two different things. Police against infringement of people's right, like stealing, and so that's where it really started, right? Soldiers did that in a municipality before they had police officers. But maintaining the peace is preventing crowds from getting out of hand, and to prevent riots.
Right. So Marlene makes the point of distinguishing between keeping the peace on the one hand and enforcing law on the other. But to a certain extent, that's a semantic distinction. Because as we will see when we see number three, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Act talks about the jobs of officers who are called peace officers, and it includes both roles. So it's the same, they are different tasks performed by the same entity. You can't really distinguish. Well, let's take a look at number three. Let's take a look at the job description based on paragraph 18 of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Act. It is the duty of members who are peace officers, subject to the orders of the commissioner, A, to perform all duties that are assigned to peace officers in relation to the preservation of the peace, the prevention of crime, and of offenses against the laws of Canada and the laws in force in any province in which they may be employed, and the apprehension of criminals and offenders and others who may be lawfully taken into custody. That's a very big paragraph, right? You have to preserve the peace, prevent crime, enforce the law, and apprehend or arrest, right, criminals and offenders and others who may be lawfully taken into custody. That's all in Part A. What's left? Part B. To execute all warrants and perform all duties and services in relation thereto that may, under this Act or the laws of Canada or the laws in force in any province, be lawfully executed and performed by police officers. So they are supposed to carry out warrants that are issued under the auspices of the judiciary. They may need to, bring people in. You know what warrants are. But that's in B. C, to perform all duties that may be lawfully performed by peace officers in relation to the escort and conveyance of convicts and other persons in custody to or from any courts, places of punishment or confinement, asylums or other places. Okay. So not only apprehending people, but also transporting them. And last, the catch-all, to perform such other duties and functions as are prescribed by the governor in council or the commissioner. Okay, anything else that we feel like asking them to do, we could also ask them to do. That's your description. So it's preserving the peace, preventing crime, apprehending or moving those who have been accused of crime, executing warrants from the judiciary. Does this cover basically I mean, other than the catch-all, whatever else we give them. But this is basically what police do. Diane?
What if the judiciary asks them to do something that's following orders? That's not right. That's a bad thing to do.
Right.
They contravene A, B, and C.
Right. So that's not in this paragraph of the Act, and I must admit I didn't look to see whether there's anything in the Act about what to do if they believe that they have received an illegal order. In military settings, there are provisions for that. Especially, obviously, since World War II. But there are provisions for what's called in the Israeli army, pikuda belichukit or ichukit be'alil, which means a clearly illegal order. At a point where you say, well, what I'm being told to do is wrong. And then there is a chain of reporting and how you're supposed to deal with the, with the problem, without being accused of mutiny. But I don't know what the mechanism is, but yes, any system like this has to have some kind of ombudsman, somebody who they're able to approach if they in fact feel like they're being told to do something that's wrong. But are we in agreement that this basically fits the description of what police do? Does this? Okay. So what about in Jewish law? Because we've been talking for 26 minutes and we haven't yet gotten to the Jewish side of things. So in Jewish law, there are certain parallels and, surprise, some differences. The most basic element of the obligation of an officer, and I hesitate to use the word police, because it's not a Hebrew word, really. We'll see what the word is in Hebrew, but anybody know? Mishtara is the term we use for the police department. What does it actually mean? It doesn't mean police. Shoter is a term for an individual police officer. What does that mean? Guard? That could be shomer. Shoter is a different word. So we'll see. We're going to talk about it very shortly. Take a look at source number 4, please. This is the classic verse you have to start with. In Hebrew, it begins, Shofetim v'shoterim titein lecha b'chol she'arecha. You shall place shofetim. Shofetim we usually translate as judges. And shoterim, which I translated as officers. Shoterim, mishtara, officers at all of your gates, which Hashem your God gives you for your tribes, and they shall judge the nation righteously. So what does this word shoter actually mean? Take a look at source number 5. Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra, who is one of the lead biblical commentators who you have to consult anytime you want to understand a text, he's very much a literalist as well as a linguist. He loves grammar. So he loves vocabulary. Look what he says here. And officers, shoterim, I transliterated the Hebrew here, these are the rulers. He says shoterim means rulers. And in Hebrew, the word is moshlim. Where did he get that from? He quotes you a verse from Mishlei, from Proverbs, which says shoter and moshel. And he quotes you a verse from Job, the mishtar of the heavens over the land, meaning shin tet resh are the Hebrew letters. Shoter is somebody who is in charge, somebody who is a master of something, somebody who is in control, meaning the judge judges and the officer compels the criminal. This person is the power behind the law. The person who gives the ruling teeth. When the law says this isn't allowed, the police officer is the enforcer. When somebody breaks the law, the police officer is the one who's supposed to rein them in and is supposed to bring them to justice. That's the way that the position of shoter is envisioned. And what's also interesting about it is that phrase that he uses at the end of source number 5, the judge judges and the officer compels the criminal. So to whom does the officer report? To the judge, to the judiciary. The police officer operates as an arm of the courts. Now, this doesn't exist in modern rabbinical courts. Modern rabbinical courts, and really, for the most part, rabbinical courts for the last 1,600 years or so, have not had that kind of authority to be able to enforce law in this way. The judges were ordained historically. If you go back to biblical times, if you go back to Talmudic times, most of the Talmudic era, a rabbinical judge who sat on a court was ordained by a mentor and was only ordained to fill a spot, meaning it was much like the modern judiciary. You don't have judge school, and people graduate from judge school, and then become judges and go looking for, you know, a position somewhere. It doesn't work that way. You have a bench, and the bench has a vacancy, and then they'll take somebody and elevate to the position of judge or transfer somebody from one court to another court, but you only become a judge because there was a position that was actually open. That was the way that it worked in terms of rabbinic ordination. You were certified as a rabbi because there was a community where there was a need for somebody to be the authority. You didn't have roaming rabbis, so to speak, where you just got your ordination and then you set up shop, you know, next to the rabbi down the block. That's a more modern phenomenon. That's why you had a concept of a term you may be familiar with. It's an Aramaic term, Mara D'Asra. And when you ever hear that phrase? Mara D'Asra means the authority in the area. The one who's supposed to answer questions. And that's something that has pretty much gone by the wayside at this point in the Jewish world. Everybody thinks they're the Mara D'Asra. Everybody thinks that they are the one who's in charge. But historically, that was the way it worked. However, hang on, in the 5th century, roughly, the Romans succeed in putting a halt to rabbinic ordination. They had a very effective way to prevent it. Rabbinic ordination could not be done by letter from afar. There was a convening of a rabbinical court, and they would ordain the rabbi. And what they said was, some of you have heard this from me before, in the event that that we find that someone has been ordained, we're going to execute the rabbi who was ordained. We're going to execute all the rabbis who were involved in the ordination process, and we will execute the Jewish community of the nearest town. And that put a halt to ordination. Since ordination had to be direct, teacher to student, you couldn't do it. And what that means is what we've had ever since is certification of expertise. It says that this rabbi has studied the information, has been tested on the information, seems to know what he's talking about. But it doesn't come with all the powers that rabbinical courts classically had, and among them is the power to actually enforce a law with a police force. So that hasn't been an option. Communities have had other mechanisms over time of enforcement, but not what we're describing here. Stephen.
Not enforcement, but in the modern synagogue, I know in the conservative movement, I thought in the Orthodox movement, the Mara D'Asra determines the halacha that's applied to that, to his congregation.
Good luck. I wish you luck.
I've seen many teshuvas that rabbis have written that are to be followed. In the case of Brenda Zemai,
So my answer to you is the following. The system of law is available in which there is a rabbinic authority, and yes, people are supposed to go to the rabbinic authority with a question of Jewish law and get a response and carry it out. Absolutely. And I'm sure there is a world in which that's the way things work. However, in the modern age, thanks to a variety of forces, everything from the turmoil of communities post-Holocaust in which communities moved to the same block, but they still identified as their own community, to the fact that you have synagogues that are close together, each of which has rabbis, to the growth of the internet and global communication so that I don't need to ask my rabbi because I can email somebody online who doesn't know me at all and doesn't know my community but will be more than happy to furnish an answer. And that's okay also because I can read 10 articles online and make the answer, draw my own conclusions. The result is that system is the exception in many communities rather than the rule. Not always so. There are communities where it still operates in a more orderly fashion. I am a believer in the idea that I think it should be the way it was. Meaning I think that we have many disadvantages to the current way of doing things. You get people who receive answers that don't really fit their situation because they're asking somebody who doesn't really know them. You have situations in which, in one community, people will be practicing a variety of different things, and it creates problems. I can't eat in that person's home. You know, it creates doubt. Why are they doing it this way, and I'm doing it that way? Because the people who are answering the questions are not responsible to the community, aren't even aware of what the community is doing. I think it creates all sorts of problems of irresponsibility to do things the way that we do them. Nonetheless, it's a reality that is certainly, I can't speak for the conservative community, but certainly within the Orthodox community, there are many people who will go rabbi shopping and look for the answer that they either like or that they are confident in. But going back to our topic at hand, because we were talking about police officers. The one role that we see here is the role of enforcing the law as ordered by the judge. You also have the phenomenon of arresting what could be called a flight risk. If you take a look at source number 6, it talks about a case of assault. Person X assaulted person Y. You have an assailant and you have a victim. The biblical text says, if the victim rises and walks about in the market, so in other words, he was knocked down, he's hurt, but then he walks up, gets up, and he's okay. Then the assailant is absolved, meaning he didn't kill him. Okay. Only he must pay for the victim's period of rest, time lost from work, and heal him. He has to pay medical bills for the person he harmed. There are also additional damages that have to be paid. There's something called depreciation that has to be paid. He has to pay for pain that was caused. He has to pay for any embarrassment that was caused. What it's saying here is that he's just not getting the death penalty because, after all, the guy got up and walked around. However, the text describes the case where 2 days go by, 3 days go by, and then he gets up, and then he walks around. And so what happens during that intervening period? And the Talmud states that in that intervening period, I didn't bring the passage from the Talmud here, it's on Sanhedrin, page 78, for those who are interested, but then we have the police imprison the assailant. You have to hold on to him. Right now, he's a flight risk. We don't have the concept of bail. We just hold on to him and say, let's see what happens. Cool your heels for a while you wait and see the results of your actions. Yes, Betty.
So what if it's the police that do the injury?
So if the police are the ones who did it, then the police officer personally will have to be arrested for it. We're going to get to that case. We're not there. We're not there yet. Where did I have it on here? I did have it on here. It's the number 17. So it's the very last source. So we'll get to that. Not today necessarily, but we'll get to it. I'm good with that. I'm being laid back this series. We're good.
Oh,
Elaine.
Just a clarification. When it says that the judge judges and the officer compels the criminal.
Yes.
Is there a concept of a police force involved, or are these military officers?
So there's no indication that this is military, meaning they're not structured in that way. They also don't even seem to be an organized police force as much as agents of that particular court. It doesn't sound like, I'm going to go back on this a little bit later on, but right now, from what we've seen so far, it doesn't sound like there's any form of like a police station where they hang out until they're delegated to a particular court to go do things. It sounds like it's more like the judge reports to work and the officer of the court reports to work. And, you know, operating more or less in a vacuum is what it sounds like right now. We're going to see another possible way to look at it, but that's the way it seems based on what we've seen so far. Rabbi Chaim David Alevi was a major authority in Jewish law in the middle of the 20th century in Israel. And he talked about this idea of arresting a flight risk, and he pointed to precedent biblically. Two stories. One is in source number 7, the other is source number 8. The first one, the one that's in source number 7, is the case known in Hebrew as the Megadef. There was a woman by the name of Shlomit Bat Divri. This story takes place after the Jews have gotten out of Egypt. They're in the wilderness on their way towards the land of Israel. And a fight breaks out between the son of Shlomit Bat Divri and some other guy who's anonymous. The son is also anonymous. Shlomit is the only one who gets named in this story. But Shlomit produced this son from an Egyptian man. And that's part of the story, and that's why in number 7, this person is identified as the son of the Jewish woman, meaning he had only one Jewish parent, as opposed to the other person in the story who has two Jewish parents. So, take a look at the verse from Leviticus. And the son of the Jewish woman declared the name. The name is the name of God. And cursed. He blasphemed against God in his fight. And they brought him to Moshe, to Moses. His mother's name was Shlomit Bat Divri of the tribe of Dan. And they put him under guard for it to be explained to them from God. The question was, so what do we do with this guy? What's the appropriate penalty for what he has done? The backstory to this, the Talmud picks up on the way we keep on playing up his heritage and what tribe he was from and what his mother's name was, and they give two different, not necessarily competing, stories about where this fellow came from. Anyone familiar with this? Okay, we got one. So what was his backstory? Correct. If you go back to the story in Egypt where Moses breaks up the incident in which an Egyptian is attacking and beating a Jew, the story was that the Egyptian had raped the Jew's wife, and when the Jew protested, so he was going to kill the Jew, and the son is this fellow here. That's one story that's associated with this. The other story is that this fight that broke out here in the wilderness was about land. Because this fellow does not have a tribe. Right? Tribal association is patrilineal in the wilderness. And so therefore he has no tribe. And all the Jews are camped in their formation as they travel through the wilderness based on their tribe. And so he says, I want to set up my tent based on my mother's tribe, because I don't have a father's tribe. It's just, you know, my mother is from the tribe of Dan, that's where I want to be. And this other fellow says, get off my land. I am legitimately from the tribe of Dan, you don't belong here. And then he gets angry and he curses God. Look at my situation here. I'm, you know, through no fault of my own, through no fault of my mother, I am in this situation where I'm an outcast. I have nowhere to go. And Dan specifically, because Dan travels last in the wilderness. In their formation, the tribe of Dan is at the end. So he's sort of at the end of the line, and even there, he can't find acceptance. It's a tragic story. But that's not why I'm quoting it. I'm quoting it here only because they have to put him under guard. The other case that... Mishmar. The other case is source number 8, involving somebody known as the Mikoshesh. Also, very interesting story. There is a man who is not named, who is found, I translated, the verse in number 8 as gathering wood. The word in Hebrew is Mikoshesh, which is a very odd word. Not a straightforward word. It's also used in Egypt when the Jews are gathering straw for bricks, like koshesh kash, lateven. So the Talmud has a discussion. Was he transporting wood on the Sabbath, and he was doing it in a public domain, and therefore you're not allowed to transport through a public area on Shabbat? Was it that he was piling up the wood, which can involve a separate prohibition? Was it that he was uprooting the wood? But whatever it was that he was doing in the wilderness, first of all, clearly this is not consistent with the image of being out in a desert where there are no trees growing, right? They're in some place where there are trees. The answer is that they must have been in some place where there was wood, because otherwise the story doesn't happen. Don't fool yourself into thinking that they're just wandering around sand dunes, you know, all 40 years. There are other events that happen in that period that indicate that, no, they weren't only in sand dunes. But in terms of this story, they find him and they don't know what to do. So they brought him to Moshe, to Moses, and to Aaron, and to the whole nation, and they put him under guard for what they should, for what should be done to him had not been explained. They didn't know what to do. See, he needed somebody to watch him. And there's a lot of discussion also. There's backstory on this one as well. Why was he doing this? Maybe his goal was actually to teach people the importance of Shabbat, so he wanted them to see what would happen. That's its own story as well. How we know who he was. Was he Tzlafchad? All interesting, but not to the point for our discussion. The second role of the police officer in Judaism is to arrest the flight risk. The third one, I use the term flight risk a little loosely, because really in the wilderness, I don't know where he was going. But nonetheless, the third is as an enforcer of Jewish law. And here, we have a passage in the Talmud in source number 9. There is a discussion there about the duty to pay back one's creditor. Right? You know that obviously if you take out a loan, if you owe somebody money, you have to pay them. So there's a debate as to whether that actually constitutes a mitzvah, repaying the creditor. Generally, it is assumed that it is a mitzvah. The only question is, which mitzvah is it? Is it about keeping your word when you made a commitment initially? Is it that it's theft if you hold on to the person's money? But if you take a look at the passage here, Rav Kahana says to Rav Papa, within your view that repaying a creditor is a mitzvah, what happens if the debtor says, that's nice, I don't want to do it? So, again, there's some debate as to which mitzvah it is. The most basic is you made a commitment at the time that you took out whatever loan it was, or you bought something and said, I'm going to pay you later, and we have a requirement to keep our word.
Right. So that isn't automatic.
Oh, you're asking why it is or is not?
It is considered a mitzvah. Like, to me, that's an automatic that you should be paying him, and why is it a good.
Right. So I want to be careful in my translation of the word mitzvah.
Okay.
The word mitzvah means commandment, yes. Not good deed.
Yeah, okay.
So now you follow.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
What about the Jubilee year?
What about the Jubilee year?
When all debts are forgiven.
So the sabbatical year, which is every 7 years, abolishes debts that are already owed for payment and have not been repaid. It resets credit for any debts that were owed, unless one takes advantage of loopholes that can enable a debt to survive the sabbatical year. And yes, there is indeed such a law. It's a biblical law that says you have to forgive it. At the same time, the Talmud also teaches that the person who borrowed the money should try to pay back the creditor. In other words, the borrower is supposed to go to the creditor and say, I'd like to pay you back. The creditor is then supposed to say, I understand, but the sabbatical year has now abolished the debt. You don't need to pay me. And then the borrower is supposed to say, I understand. Nonetheless, I'd still like to pay you back. In other words, what this is meant to do is to reset credit for people who need it, but not to the point of saying, don't worry about it. If you need to take advantage of this, take advantage of it. But we don't want people to actually feel like they have no obligation to their creditor. We also don't want to freeze the credit system, right? We saw what happened in the economy when people wouldn't lend, right? 15, 20 years ago, whatever it was, maybe a little less, when nobody could get credit. The banks stopped lending it didn't happen here as much as it happened south of the border. But it was a disaster. And that's what happens if everybody just says, well, I'm going to wait it out until the end of the 7 years. And at that point, I'm just going to wave goodbye to my creditor. Okay, but you're never getting another loan. That's where this is going. So it's the kind of law which you take advantage of in a case of desperation. But you don't actually want to be in that position. You can use the get out of jail free card once. But the passage in the Talmud here in source number 9 asks, what if he says, I don't want to perform the mitzvah? And the response that's given as the passage continues in the Talmud is kofin al mitzvat aseh, which means you can compel somebody to fulfill a commandment. He says, I don't want to pay. The rabbinical court has within its rights to send in the officer to his property and to confiscate assets and use them for payment of the debt. Now, this is clearly a very dangerous game because it's not limited to this mitzvah, right? It will apply to other mitzvot. Sukkot is coming, right? Not right now. Pesach is coming instead, but eventually Sukkot will be coming. There is a mitzvah of getting, the Arba Minim, the four species. Costs a little bit of money. Somebody says, I'm not interested. I don't want to do it. Rabbinical court says, we have a mandate. We are able to coerce somebody to fulfill a commandment. So we're going to go send the officer, and he is going to go take some money for them, purchase the four species, and hand it to them and say, here, take these. I'm not sure everybody's entirely comfortable with that idea. His. No. The person who is refusing to fulfill the mitzvah. They take his assets. Yeah.
If he doesn't have
any. So if he doesn't have any, he's exempt anyway. He's not responsible for the mitzvah if he doesn't have the means. They talk about where the person has the means. But you can go much further with this. I'm only bringing these as examples because it's important to understand that enforcement of religious law was also part of the role of this officer, and not only straightforward religious law, but public morality in general. Take a look at source number 10. This is always entertaining. Rabbi Moses Maimonides, writing in Egypt in the 12th century, and don't you forget it, because that's going to matter. He says, the courts must establish shotrim, there's that word again, right? The officers, on festivals, to patrol and search in gardens and orchards and along rivers, lest men and women gather there to eat and drink and come to sit. The concern for what happens when people are drinking, and men and women are together, and they don't mean husband and wife. So the shoter is going to be responsible to enforce public morality. They say, we'll have none of that here. You know, move along. It's a means of enforcing public morality. That's also within the role of the officer. Some people are becoming less comfortable with the role of the police officers here. That's not something that is unique to Judaism. It exists in other cultures. I'm certain that Maimonides saw it in Egypt in the 12th century. But this is something where Maimonides is not the originator of this. This is something that goes back long before him within Judaism. And then the last role is enforcer of municipal regulations. So, example of that, honest weights and measures. Right? You have a Bureau of Weights and Measures, or something along those lines in the U.S., I'm assuming in Canada as well. Right? They're responsible to make sure that businesses conduct themselves in an honest way, that the scales are set properly and all of that. Right? That exists here too, I assume. It's the sort of thing that's sort of built into modern society, I think. But goes back a couple of thousand years in the Jewish system. Take a look at source number 11. There's a biblical verse, it appears a couple of times in different ways, which requires us to keep honest weights and measures. Honest weights and measures shall be for you. And actually, in one of the cases where the Torah speaks of that, it says, in the event that you maintain honest weights and measures, then you will have a long life. You earn long life for being an honest business person. That's the promise. So I mentioned that because of what's going to happen here in source number 11. The Talmud says, the fact that the Torah says, these shall be for you, yehiyalach, teaches that society has to do things to make sure that we will have these honest weights and measures. This teaches that they appoint officers for measures, although not for prices. And there's a lot of discussion about that, meaning that you can enforce that the scales are accurate, that the weights are accurate. However, if you go back to Roman times, we also had regulated prices. It was a quasi-socialist system in which the government declared that there was a certain range of acceptable prices for various goods. So he says that we're not going to have officers in force. However, the house of the prince, the Nasi, was the political leader of the Jews in Israel. They appointed officers for both measures and prices. As Rami Bar Chama quoted Rabbi Yitzchak, we appoint officers for both measures and prices. Why? Due to cunning people. Because otherwise people play games. People are going to gouge on prices, or people are going to cheat with their measures. And the Talmud describes what people would do. They would put away their weights at night in a container of salt. Why salt? So that's interesting. I wouldn't have thought I didn't think of the water thing. You're a better cheater than I am. I just assumed it would corrode the weight. It'll corrode the metal. It makes it lighter. Exactly. So you're telling everybody, I'm giving you a measure of whatever it is, but in fact, your measure is light. And therefore, you're not giving them what they purchased. I didn't think about the water one. That's an interesting possibility as well. This is a matter of law in what are Maimonides, brought in the code of Jewish law to have this sort of protection. I believe Ramaim, some version of Ramaim is what's brought there. Mipnei HaRamaim. The Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, makes sure that you understand that enforcement of municipal law is not viewed as a separate secular responsibility. Rather, it's viewed as a religious responsibility. Take a look at source number 12. The Jerusalem Talmud quotes you the verse in Leviticus. Leviticus 19:36 says, just scales, just stone weights, and so on you shall have. The sages said, for any mitzvah, like this one, where the reward is biblically stated beside it, the words in brackets are words that I added just because the sentence flows better, the courts do not enforce it. Meaning, if the Torah says, do this and you'll have a long life, then the court says, well, we don't need to enforce it. They already promised long life. Of course they're going to stick to it. To which they ask, but wait a minute, Deuteronomy says, honest weights and measures shall be for you, the verse we quoted in number 11, which we interpret to mean you're supposed to set up enforcing officers for this. And yet you would say this? So their statement is, I don't care that the biblical text promised a reward. You better put police officers out there anyway. Not everybody is going to put the biblical reward ahead of what they conceive to be their financial interest. So you're better off, have the officers. And if they have nothing to do, that'll be nice. But the point that I bring this for, the reason why I highlight this source, is because it's telling you that having the enforcers out there to do this, even though you're talking about enforcing municipal law, fundamentally, meaning it's not a rabbi's job to set the price for eggs, right? It's government that's doing it. Nonetheless, enforcing the government's price for eggs is also a religious duty. It's also viewed as religious. And this is going to matter a great deal next week in what we're going to get to. But to sum up what we've said at this point, we began by highlighting the problem, right? And the problem, to state it succinctly, is that we are given in society we have a need to enforce the law, and we have a need for protecting the peace, and that requires that we have officers, but we give them power that they can use to abuse people, whether directly and intentionally or unintentionally, like when they have to make that decision about enforcing the peace versus enforcing the law. So how do you create a system that's going to enable this to work, at least in the majority of cases? We showed Chief of Police Ramsey's solution to the problem. Police should see themselves as agents of the people. However, we noted that at the end of the day, you're an agent of government. So how is that really going to help you? So we said, let's first look at the job description. And the job description of the police department under the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Act is to preserve the peace, to preserve the law preventing crime, to apprehend the accused, to move them from place to place, to execute warrants from the judiciary. And in Jewish law, it's relatively similar. Right? In Jewish law, we said it's to punish at the judge's instruction. It is to arrest a flight risk. It is to enforce Jewish law and to enforce municipal regulations. About the only thing I see in there that was not in the secular job description was to actually be the agent of punishment. Meaning, if a court decides, if a secular court decides that somebody goes to jail, you have corrections officers. That's a separate unit. It's not really the same as, they couldn't call in a police officer off the street and say, watch this person in the jail cell. So I think in that, to that extent, it may not be found in the secular system. But there's a lot more, I think, that we need to talk through. What I want to do next week is, first of all, to take the problem a step or two steps further, make the problem worse about this tension between the two sides, and then move into showing what the solution is as conceived within the Jewish system before moving on to some of the applications that that come from there. Thank you very much. I'm going to stick around again for anybody who needs to register, get themselves on the email list, pay. As I say always, I just want to make sure to note this, as I always say with this, if a person finds paying for the class a hardship, I'd rather that you sign up and that you be receiving the emails and here in the classes, getting the notifications, even if the $10 a week is difficult. Thank you very much.